Welcome back to Tales of Southwest Michigan's Past. This is Michael Delaware. I am your host. And a lot of people don't know how I started this podcast because they may or may not have known about me on YouTube. And I just started the podcast and they started following at some point in my journey here. This is the third season of Tales of Southwest Michigan's Past. It all began about 4 years ago during the 2020 lockdowns and all that. I started revisiting my YouTube channel that had been basically sitting there since 2010. I had not posted a lot of videos in quite a while. I had started that channel with a different purpose many, many years ago. But during the 2020 lockdown, I decided, as many people did, to try to do something to occupy my time because work was slow and you couldn't really go anywhere and all this fun stuff, as we all remember. So at one point I decided, well, I'm going to use some of my additional free time to do something that I enjoyed. And one of the things that I sat down and made a list of was that I really enjoyed making videos on YouTube. But what I didn't enjoy was running out of ideas or not really feeling like I was connecting with people. So at that point, I decided to take some classes and that sort of thing on Skillshare online, which is an online learning platform. And I learned from other YouTube content creators. And I came out of there with the idea for one of the classes that you should only really put together a YouTube channel on a topic or subject that you have a lot of interest in. And if you're not passionate about it, you're going to run out of content and you're not going to be on purpose with what you want to do. And so at that point, I said, well, that's really where I derailed earlier because I didn't really have a direction or purpose. I was just doing random videos. And I started thinking that I really wanted to do something to help my community. And I looked up the city of Battle Creek on YouTube. And at that time, there was nothing but a few negative videos about the community posted by people that were just had an axe to grind or whatever. And I thought, wow, this is not great content for somebody coming from out of the area. So I decided that was where I was going to start, just creating positive videos about my community. And I began with what I was passionate about, which was hiking trails. And I did a bunch of videos on hiking trails, and I walked around the community doing little short videos on different hiking trails that were available in town. And then I kind of ran out of hiking trails. And one day I was downtown Battle Creek and I saw all of these historic markers. And I thought, I wonder if people would be interested if I just did a video on that, because I've personally never read these historic markers. So I walked around town and I just essentially read what was on the historic markers while I was recording. And the people really responded to it. And they took an interest themselves, and many of them started going to check out these markers. And then I did another video, and then I ran out of historic markers in my town. And I went over to Marshall and did another video with markers over there. And I finally decided that I was going to go to Oak Hill Cemetery, and because there was a couple of historic markers out there. And I did a video on the prominent graves at Oak Hill Cemetery. And that video did surprisingly better than a lot of the other videos I'd been posting. And then I thought, well, what do I do next? And at one point, I looked around at all of the headstones in Oak Hill Cemetery, and I thought to myself, wow, beneath every one of them is a story. And this cemetery is more than just about W.K. Kellogg and C.W. Post and Ellen White and Sojourner Truth and the big prominent ones that people are familiar with at this cemetery. But there's hundreds, there's literally thousands of stories here that are waiting to be told. So that's how I began. So today, I'm going to be telling you a story of something that I recently discovered at a local cemetery. And it was here in Battle Creek. And it's the story of the Lawler family. So come along and join me. So I know that was kind of a big introduction, but I wanted to just kind of give you that background on how I started down this path that I've been on for almost 4 years now of researching history. And the biggest starting point for me, I would say, was obviously the historic marker videos. But when I started digging into the history of cemeteries and people that were buried in there, I began at Oak Hill Cemetery in Battle Creek and just filming headstones and walking around. And then I would come back and sit in front of my computer and do research hours on end to try to find the story behind who that person was. And sometimes I ran into a dead end and didn't find any material on the person. But many times I did. And over time, I became a better researcher the more I did that. And I learned about more places to search for material on people, including genealogy records and biographical records and not just newspapers. And then I became a better researcher using old newspaper databases, because there's really a skill set that no one ever teaches you that takes a while to learn. And when you start learning how some of those search engines work on there, you can become a better researcher and find the material. So in the past 4 years, I don't claim to be 100% of an expert, but I am certainly a greater expert on searching than the Michael Delaware that started the videos 4 years ago, I can tell you that. So I'm better than I was at the beginning. And so over time, I have been visiting other cemeteries and doing research and challenging myself. I've even gone to cemeteries that had no published newspaper in those communities, and digging up records and finding without a local newspaper database to search through is a challenge indeed. So if you go on my YouTube channel, you can see some of these videos that I've created on various cemeteries. Across the street from Oak Hill Cemetery is a cemetery called Mount Olivet Cemetery. Now, it was established in 1875, and it is a Catholic cemetery. Oak Hill Cemetery was established in 1844, although there are graves that are older than 1844 at Oak Hill, and that is primarily because two other cemeteries were relocated to Oak Hill after it was opened. And so if the person that they were disinterring and reinterring at Oak Hill had a cemetery headstone or marker of some kind, that got transferred with the body and reset at the Oak Hill Cemetery. So you will see stones that predate 1844 at Oak Hill Cemetery as a death date. And that's just a little bit of a historical background for you. And you may experience that with other cemeteries in your community across the United States, because in times when they had to relocate a cemetery, that would be the case. So the story about Olivet Cemeteries was established in 1875 by the Catholic Church. And obviously, to be buried in there, you have to be a member of that faith. That's one of the restrictions that they have. They also have some interesting things about their cemeteries, is they will not allow somebody who committed suicide to be buried there. Now, that was historically the case. I don't know if that's currently how they think about it in present day, but that was the case early on. And so if somebody committed suicide and it wasn't determined to be an accident, then they would not be permitted to be buried in Mount Olivet. The story I'm going to tell you today is one that I went to Mount Olivet Cemetery with the intention of filming some very different headstones, and I found those headstones I was looking for very quickly, and I was preparing to put a video together on those stories because I had some biographical material on these stones of these people buried there. And I never got to it because I ended up, while I was there, I thought, well, let me just film a few more interesting headstones while I'm here and see if I can come up with some additional stories. And I did, and I found this one stone that was kind of unique. It was a stone on top of a stone, and the stone on top said Simon Lawler, and the one on the bottom said M. Lawler, which was the father, I found out. And the son had his stone marker on top of his father's family stone. And so I thought that was quite interesting. And I started digging into who these people were. And the more and more I researched it, I found information that was surprising about the history of this family. So I'm going to take you now through the journey that I went through in researching the history of this family. Before I begin, I wanted to tell you that my book, Victorian Southwest Michigan True Crime, is now available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and wherever books are sold. You can also go to MichaelDelaware.com and order a book there, and I will send you a personally signed copy. The collection of stories contains 17 true crime stories that happened during the 1800s in the Southwest Michigan area. And you can also find a calendar on my website at MichaelDelaware.com that shows where my upcoming speaking engagements are. So if you're interested in meeting me in person and hearing some stories from the book, check out the calendar. Now on with today's story about the Lawler family. Carter Michael Lawler came from Ireland, settling in a home near Verona, just northeast of Battle Creek, in 1856. He went by his middle name Michael, and he resided at 768 Maple Street. He would remain in that home for 55 years. For many years, he was a cobbler, bringing his trade with him from his home country, servicing the footwear needs of the new community. Michael had married Ann Welch prior to his move to America, and together they had four children, Simon, John, Mary, and Elizabeth. Ann, like Michael, was a well-respected member of the Battle Creek community, and together they were active parishioners at the St. Philip's Catholic Church. Ann would pass away sadly in 1903 at the age of 73, following a battle with pneumonia. Michael passed away at age 86 in 1911 from what was described as general debility. Their oldest son was Simon Daniel Lawler, but most people knew him as Sam. He was born February 2, 1859, and he grew up on Maple Street. And as a young boy, he began working with the Grand Trunk Railroad as a call boy. His job was to go to the homes of the sleeping engineers and other railroad workers and knock on their doors to wake them up to call them to work. Over the years with the Grand Trunk Railroad, he worked his way up to becoming an engineer himself. He retired from the railroad to enter the dray business. In the 1900s, the dray business was a delivery service by horse-drawn carts or side carts, which would receive goods at a shipping port or railroad station and deliver them a short distance in town to a buyer. Dray carts or sleds were often designed to carry heavy loads such as beer barrels or large bags of grain or other such materials, and they had low sides. He would remain in that business only a short time until 1906, and at the age of 47, he joined the Battle Creek Police Department during a time when it was still the horse and buggy era in the city under Police Chief William Farrington. As a patrolman in the city, he was a familiar face. He worked for the police department for 26 years and was considered by most citizens to be the best-known police officer in the area at the time. During his time with the police department, he saved many lives and was fondly remembered as the Irish philosopher around the police headquarters with his wit and wisdom. In 1932, the Battle Creek City Commission discharged Simon Lawler along with four other police veterans, Captain Donald McDonald, Sergeant Andrew Cronin, Patrolman Harry Davis, and Police Matron Edith Dolan, stating they had outlived their usefulness to the department. Their discharges came at a time before the city started paying pensions to its retired policemen and firemen, and so this decision came down suddenly and was a profound shock to these veteran officers. Patrolman Lawler led a fight and protest against these discharges. First, he fought for the benefits of the Battle Creek Police Relief Association, and later for a pension. Leading the group of discharged officers, he carried the fight all the way to the district court, but they lost to a decision carried down by Judge Blaine Hatch in 1933. Simon married Catherine Purcell on October 28, 1884, and together they had nine children, four sons and five daughters. His sons were Frank, Harry, William, and Percy. His daughters were Betty, Florence, Rosemarie, Pauline, and Winifred. His wife Catherine passed away in 1934, 1 year after the final court decision in his long battle over pensions. The extreme tragedy in this family was that Simon would see all four of their sons and one daughter buried in his lifetime. Winifred Lawler was born in 1898, and at just 9 years old, she would die from an illness in 1907. Harry Lawler, the second oldest son, like his brothers and sisters, grew up in Battle Creek. After high school, like his father, he worked for the Grand Trunk Railroad. He would eventually become an engineer, and in 1914, he made a career change and began working with a lumber company out in Oregon. In 1917, he went off to serve in the Great War in Europe, Europe, and upon his return, he continued with the lumber business out west. In December of 1919, he was working near Astoria, Oregon, with a logging company, and he was killed in a log slide off of a railroad car. His body was returned to Battle Creek, and he was buried at Mount Olivet Cemetery. The story of William Lawler, the third oldest son, is perhaps the most interesting and yet saddest tale in the family history. During World War I, known as the Great War, he served in the Navy as a wireless operator. Always athletic as a young man, it was during his time in the Navy that he became active in boxing. In May of 1920, he won his first out-of-town boxing match against his opponent, Chief Gatcher, an experienced Native American fighter, in a 10-round bout. Becoming known locally as Sailor Bill Lawler in the welterweight category, in June of that year, he defeated veteran boxer Joe Burton in a match in Jackson, Michigan, in an 8-round semifinal. He later fought an Englishman named Billy Holmes in Kalamazoo and was defeated in a decision but prevailed over him in a rematch in Marshall in January 1921. The two would fight each other a third time in Grand Rapids a week later, where Lawler defeated Holmes again. Following this, William was considered a top aspirant for the Michigan welterweight title. He next faced Mickey Brennan in a match in Muskegon, where he prevailed again, and he was then booked to fight Newt McClassland in a fight in Lansing. This opponent, the newspapers compared the two fighters to have the same free and open style of boxing, and thus were equally matched. The outcome of this match was that it was declared a draw, with neither fighter being declared the victor. William continued fighting through 1921 around the state, many times revisiting previous opponents like Chief Gatcher and Mickey Brennan, and finally had his first bout in Detroit in a match with Phil Guzmano in 1922. He would go on to defeat the less experienced boxer and continue fighting around the state through 1922, facing opponents like Red Curry in Kalamazoo, and later fighting soldiers in a match at Camp Custer. Sailor Bill Lawler was a favorite of Battle Creek fans during those years, and he would eventually put his boxing career behind him and become a young detective at the Battle Creek Police Department, following in his father's footsteps. He married Nora Ann O'Connell and was considered a talented upcoming police officer in the department, and was widely liked for having a keen sense of humor. He loved Nora Ann above all others in his life, and in 1929, he was by her side when she became seriously ill and taken to Nichols Hospital. The doctors informed him she needed immediate surgery or she would die. Bill was reluctant at first to concede to the risky procedure, but he consented when the doctors told him, "It's the only chance, Bill. We have got to operate. It is do or die." She went into surgery and passed away at 2:30 p.m. on December 31st. Devastated, Bill went home to his house on Division Street to pick out a dress for Nora to be buried in. He laid it carefully out for her to be found, and then sat down and wrote out a note and placed it in his own front pocket. He then took out a revolver and shot himself in the head. It was 4:15 p.m. in the afternoon. The note in his pocket was written to his father, and it said, "I want you to have everything. Look after things. Forgive me, Bill." Bill and Nora are not buried at Mount Olivet Cemetery, but are buried side by side at Memorial Park Cemetery in Battle Creek. Joseph Purcell Lawler, the youngest son, otherwise known as Percy, had grown up in Battle Creek. He was born in the family home on Division Street, and after he left high school, he also worked as a call boy for the Grand Trunk Railroad like his father, and later as a gasoline station attendant. He then got a job driving trucks between Michigan and California, and in July of 1935, he'd been in an automobile accident out in California and spent 3 months recovering in a hospital out there. In October 1935, Percy had just returned home to Battle Creek when, within a few days, he was struck and killed by a Grand Trunk passenger train not far from the train station, about 100 yards from the home that he was born. Initially, the family didn't know it was Percy who had been killed. Simon noticed that Percy had not come home, and seeing that there was an unidentified man mentioned having been killed in a newspaper article. The man was said to be carrying a handkerchief with the the initials J and L on it. He visited the Shaw funeral home and was able to identify his son. Initially, rumors abounded that Percy had killed himself by stepping in front of the train, but after an investigation, it was ruled an accident. Percy is buried at Mount Olivet Cemetery in the family plot. 2 years later, Frank Lawler, the last son of the family, would pass away following a bout with pneumonia in February of 1937. He, too, had worked in the Grand Trunk Railroad and was well known in those circles. He had been an employee for 28 years with the railroad. Like his father and brothers, he had begun his service there as a call boy, and the last 15 years, he'd been an engineer. He's also buried at Mount Olivet Cemetery in the family plot. Simon Sam Lawler passed away in 1945 at the age of 86, and he's buried at Mount Olivet Cemetery. He was survived by his three daughters, Rose Marie, who died in 1951 at the age of 64, and she's buried at Memorial Park. Helen, who died in 1952 at the age of 54, and she is buried at Memorial Park as well. And Florence, who died in 1953 at age 57, and she's buried down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And Betty, who died in 1967 at the age of 72 in Colorado Springs, Colorado. That concludes the story of the Lawler family, filled with tragedy, which connects both Mount Olivet Cemetery and Memorial Park Cemetery in Battle Creek. So that concludes today's journey through history. I hope that you found that story fascinating. A lot of tragedy in the Lawler family, and a lot of fascinating people as well. I mean, there's certainly a very big railroad history with that family, with many of the sons being involved with the railroad, and then also a law enforcement history with the father and son both being police officers. So it's a very interesting history, Catholic family, Irish Catholic, and I found the story compelling in a lot of ways. Kind of sad about how some of the tragic accidents that happened to the sons, and all four of his sons passing away before he died. That was pretty shocking to me when I found that out. So I decided to put in a special video about the Lawler family, and you can watch that on YouTube. This is the same information that was in that video. But that's going to do it for today's journey through history. Now, I wanted to tell you about some upcoming exciting events that I've got going on that I'm in the process of working on. You may remember that I did a true crime symposium that I was promoting, and if you'd visited my website, you would have seen the graphics on that, or maybe been around Facebook and seen me promoting that event. That was held in Jackson, Michigan on April 6th, and it came about from an idea that I had with Judy Gail Krasnow, who was a guest on my show a few times about her book Jacktown. And she mentioned to me after I'd got done interviewing one day that, you know, when your book comes out, Michael, give me a call and I'll set up a book signing for you here in Jackson. And when my publication date came around, I started reaching out to her. I said, hey, I'd like to get something going in Jackson, because obviously the people in a true crime book in that era went to the Jackson prison. And there was also one story from Jackson in the book. And so she said, well, you know, things have changed. I don't really have a venue here at the old prison to do a book signing. However, right across the street, there is a event facility called Art 634. And I'm good friends with those folks. I'll put in a referral for you and give you her number and give them a call. So I reached out to Art 634 and spoke with a lady by the name of Andrea there and pitched her the idea, hey, I'd like to come do a book signing. Can I use your facility? And she said, oh, yeah, we'll give you a space for free. And it's a big venue and blah, blah, blah. And the more I talked, I realized that this was a big venue for a single book signing. I mean, this was going to be pretty huge for just me as a solo author to come. And I thought to myself while I was talking to her, I said, what if I did something where maybe Judy and I came and signed books, and maybe I invited a few other authors, and we kind of call it a true crime symposium. And that just came to me as it was something I'd been bouncing around in my head a while back, but I never put it together until I talked to Andrea. And she said, oh, that'd be wonderful. And then we just started working out the details, and it just kind of went from there. And as I approached the event, I ended up having five authors, including myself, agree to attend this True Crime Symposium. And as I approached the event, I decided, well, how am I going to do this format? What is a symposium, you know, for people? What would that be like? And I just kind of imagined myself being an attendee at something. What would I want to see? I wouldn't want to see a lot of long talking, but I want to see a variety of talking. So I arranged it so that each author spoke for 10 minutes. And then we had this social hour where we met with people and mingled and we signed books and we sold books. And the feedback from the public at this event afterwards was tremendous. And I was overwhelmed. Now, I only sold 7 or 8 books. It was a great event for me, obviously, because it was worth my time going there to sell 7 books, I think I sold. And some of the other authors sold 8 or 9, which was great. Between all of us, I think we sold about 35 books. But all of the authors felt like they had gotten something out of it, and they all enjoyed the experience. And we had, you know, good positive feedback from them. But what was interesting is the audience really enjoyed it. And they hung around for a bit, and they chatted with us for almost an hour after the event. And then it occurred to me that this is a model for a book signing that I really should think about doing. So I rescheduled with Art 634 to do it again next year. I haven't locked the date on the calendar yet, but before I left. But what was also interesting at this event is there was another museum, Charlotte Museum, friends of mine that were the curators of that museum, Julie Kimmer, and she's been a guest on my show before, and another woman that was with her, and they said they would like to have a symposium like this at their museum this October. And I said, great, we'll talk about it through email and put something together. So in the past 2 weeks since that event, I've been speaking with them back and forth, and we finally agreed on a date to do another true crime symposium at the Charlotte Museum. And this is going to be on October 19th. And in the meantime, when I came back to my museum here in Battle Creek, I pitched the idea to my marketing committee there, and they loved it. They wanted me to formulate a Michigan history author symposium and invite like general history on Michigan, including true crime, to this event. So I started the working on that and reached out to a bunch of authors, including many of the authors I've interviewed on this program. And at this point, the event is scheduled for that museum at the Battle Creek Regional History Museum on September 28th. And it is also a Saturday, and it's about a 3-hour event. It's going to be called the Michigan History Authors Symposium, and I'm happy to announce I have 10 authors scheduled for that one. The October one is still in the works because they scheduled after the other one got started, and I have 3 authors committed to that right now. I'm hoping to have as many as 5 or 6 for that, and I'm still waiting to hear back from some of my author colleagues if they can make the calendar date work. So that is kind of exciting news for me. I think it's good for readers, and it's an entertaining for people that are history fans, because you can come to these events and you're not just hearing from one author. You can actually hear from multiple authors. The one in Battle Creek, because I've got 10 authors, about 6 to 8 of them are going to speak. The other ones aren't going to be speaking. And we're going to do it in 2 installments where the 4 of them speak. Then we'll have a half an hour mingle, and then 4 more will speak, and then more mingling and that sort of thing. So that's going to be the format. We're still working out the details, but it's going to be a very amazing event, and I'll be putting that on my calendar very soon. You can find the September date on my calendar on my website, and the October one will be there as well. And just check that out, follow up. If you can attend, you certainly want to put that on your calendar. These are free to the public. We do encourage you to buy books from the authors that are there. You don't have to necessarily buy a book from me if you don't want to, but buy one from one of the other authors if you enjoy or are interested in what they wrote about. And it helps support local authors in Michigan, and it also kind of puts into the importance of reading. And even for young people, bring your kids to these events and you'll be able to get them reading books again. And that's really what inspires me. I grew up reading books, and I know a lot of you out there in the audience did as well. And I think this new generation spends too much time looking on their phone rather than cracking open a book. So these are good events for everybody to become inspired readers. So I just wanted to tell you a little bit about that as well. As always, you can reach out to me at michaeldelaware.com, and I'm always happy to hear from my listeners. Connect with me on Facebook at Michael Delaware Author. Follow me on that page, and you'll be kept up to date on my upcoming events and announcements. And you can also find me on Instagram at Michigan History Guy. And until next time, when we take another journey into yesterday and explore even more fascinating tales of Southwest Michigan's past. Thank you for listening.